Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the November 9th meeting of the Portland City Council. We'll get underway in a moment with the regular business of the city, but just want to take maybe a moment for us as community leaders to welcome you to a democratic process that we believe in a community that we love. I know this is a difficult day for us. Many of us are sleep-deprived and wounded. And the values that we share as a community have been called into question by what's happened in our nation. But we're here because we believe those values are real and that we can make them real in our city. We also believe in the values of civility and tolerance, and I guess I want to urge each of you to do what I've been trying to do all day, and that is particularly find a young person, better yet, a young person of color, and tell them that this is a city that welcomes everyone and where everyone has a legitimate right to participate in the process and be valued, because my kids and a lot of kids today are wondering about their future. So I hope all of us can do what we can, where we are, with what we have, to reassure one another today. We have important work to do this afternoon. We'll bear down and do it. Again, if you see us looking a little tired, it might just be because we didn't sleep last night, not because of what you're talking about. With that, I want to give my colleagues a chance to say some opening words, and then we'll start the process.
Chair, I really appreciate what you just said, and I also would note for the record, we have some very young people here today, and some people have brought their children, and your comments remind me that every day we in public life are modeling good behavior for them, and perhaps there hasn't been enough of that at the national level. So maybe locally we can set a standard that has evaded, I think, the national scene. So thank you for your comments.
You're here. Thank you all for being good Portlanders. Commissioner?
Thank you. Certainly as a woman and as an immigrant, this has been a very difficult day, and I think it has been for a lot of people. What happened yesterday, you mentioned about the young people. One of my staff just showed me a map of what would be the blue and red states if only the 18 to 25-year-olds had voted, and there were only two red states. So I think that actually our children are going to give it the best shot, that they are going to fix some of the things that I've been trying to do in my life and haven't quite made it yet. So I did want to also start with something really positive, and that is that, and by the way, I really would appreciate it if everybody's kind to each other in their testimony today. We can certainly disagree, but we can do it respectfully and without calling names and such. That would be very helpful. Why don't you give your comments, and then I'll give my happy thing.
Well, actually, I was going to say not exactly a happy thing, but make no mistake, this is a catastrophic development, and I expect this country to be unrecognizable 4 years from now. But just in terms of how we feel about our fellow citizens, it does appear that Hillary Clinton actually has won the popular vote. And my brother just sent me a poll showing that a majority of Trump voters do not want to deport all undocumented immigrants. Obviously, far too many Americans were willing to tolerate an open bigot, but I think that a lot of people just voted to blow things up because they think everything's all screwed up, so let's blow it up. And that does not necessarily mean that they have hatred in their hearts for their fellow citizens. They just had this desire to blow things up. That is not particularly encouraging, but I do not think we can draw the conclusion from yesterday that a majority of Americans are racist, sexist bigots. So if that's an uplifting message, I hereby offer it.
Uplifting thing, tomorrow we're going to announce who's won the Spirit of Portland Awards, which is always one of the council's favorite events to talk about people and companies, neighborhood associations, business associations, even some corporations who do good things in our community. So while the maximum number of people here are here, I want to announce that one of the winners is Carla Moore Love, our council clerk. So I understand that Carla served the city for over 30 years, and certainly this year in particular, she's had to put up with a lot of rowdiness, disruptions, scare tactics from some of the community members who visited, and I just wanted to say that I really appreciate not only keeping us on track, but also your service to the community.
Oh, thank you.
You're here. Thank you, Carla.
Thank you.
Let's hear it for her. And let's give her the chance to get this meeting started in proper order by calling the roll, please.
Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Hales?
Here. Welcome, everyone. Let's read the item before us for this afternoon's hearing, please. 1258.
Accept the residential infill project concept report to council as general conceptual parameters for subsequent zoning code and zoning map amendments.
Thank you. Let me introduce the subject, and then we'll have a presentation, and we'll get started with the hearing. I initiated this project last year to address a number of concerns that I've heard consistently from the community, not just these 4 years. I'll get back to that, about the eroding character of our neighborhoods from demolitions, about incompatible development that replaced some of those houses, and about the lack of affordability and challenges that Portlanders face when attempting to find housing in our great neighborhoods at a time where our housing prices are rising and where our household configurations are changing. This is particularly acute for seniors, lower-income people, and communities of color. This is not the first time that we as a community have grappled with these issues. Someone in the Planning Bureau staff found this document way back in the file somewhere. The Housing Task Force report on demolition and density from October of 1989, on which task force I served as a private citizen. And actually, when you read this report, you'll see some of the issues that we're talking about here reflected. Some of them we've addressed, some of them we still haven't addressed, and that's why we're here. This is part of a larger approach to this set of issues, obviously not being done in isolation. We are updating our comprehensive plan, a blueprint for how we're going to grow from a city of 635,000 people to a city of more than 800,000 people. And maybe after yesterday, like it or not, more people might want to move here. We've instituted a demolition delay for historic properties and additional notice to neighbors for all residential demolitions. We've required careful deconstruction of some historic homes, and I hope more soon. And we've worked to afford to expand the affordable rental housing development in our city, like all the projects that will be funded by the bond measure that Portlanders passed yesterday that you led, Commissioner Saltzman, and that will put $258 million into the provision of affordable housing in our city. We'll also soon be hearing the Planning and Sustainability Commission's recommendations on inclusionary housing, which they sent to us yesterday. So that combination of efforts are intended to try to get us the development that we want and avoid the kinds that we don't want, accommodate households in our city that are, again, different shapes and sizes, perhaps, than the one that I grew up in, and ensure that we save what we love about our city and build what we want to see. The concepts that we're going to hear about today are an important first step to ensure that our single-family neighborhoods are well-positioned to address the needs of people here today and for our children, our parents, and our friends who will be living with us in the future. So the purpose of today's hearing is to hear our staff presentation, to hear public testimony, and so that we can begin bearing down on the details of code and zoning map amendments for hearings early next year that will put these ideas into code. I know there are some folks that I'm going to call up early. We have some Planning and Sustainability Commission members here. Yes, we do. There's one. Okay, good. We have some of them here. I know we have some people with disabilities and small children and caregivers that we will provide opportunities for early, and board and commission members. So we'll take those folks first in the batting order of testimony and then everyone else as we can. So with that, let me call up our staff to make the presentation and take some council questions, and then we'll go on into testimony. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mayor. My name is Sandra Wood, and with me today is Morgan Tracy. We're both with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and we are here to share the concepts, which we're really excited to share with you, but I'm speaking of our democracy. It's really exciting to facilitate a process in which the community members have an opportunity to talk to you about this subject that we've been hearing from them for such a long time. I'm going to be sharing what we've done so far. We didn't come up with these concepts last week and are here today. We've been working on them for quite a while. And then Morgan's going to walk you through the proposal, and then we'll be hearing some testimony today. We began the process in summer of 2015 by recruiting a diverse range of stakeholders to form our stakeholder advisory committee. That included representatives from neighborhood coalition offices, and then people from the industry who build housing, like residential builders, remodelers, architects, and realtors, and then a set of advocates for anti-displacement, housing affordability, accessibility, aging in place, historic preservation, energy conservation, because all of those topics do affect the production of housing and what kind of housing is built in the city. The committee spent a considerable amount of time exchanging ideas about the topics of scale of houses, housing choice, and narrow lot development, amongst other things. But most importantly, they provided staff with a lot of insights about the pros and cons of various approaches that we were considering. So I wanted to just thank all of them publicly, and we really appreciate their thought and all the time that they spent with us and this topic. Then we brought the initial concepts out to the public this summer through a series of open houses, which I think several of you attended, meetings and hosted forums. And then we received also quite a bit of public input from a questionnaire that we had online, but we had about 2,400 respondents to the second questionnaire we did. And a majority of the respondents thought that this proposal would be very effective or somewhat effective at meeting almost all of the project's key objectives. Morgan will touch on the key objectives a little further, but they include things like maintaining neighborhood character, providing housing choices, and allowing houses to adapt over time. We feel that the whole package of the three topics that we're bringing you today really does its part to advance the goals of the comprehensive plan for a prosperous, equitable, healthy, and resilient city that we're trying to build. I wanted to remind you and the public that we're not in the legislative phase right now. As the mayor said, we're not writing the law right now, but we're hoping to receive direction from council on the concepts before we begin the detailed work of writing the code and updating the zoning map next year. You'll have two public hearings. One is, of course, today, and then the next one is next Wednesday on November 16th to help inform your decision on whether the concepts are moving us in the right direction or whether you want to make some refinements to the concepts we have before you.
And I believe the one next week is both in the afternoon and in the evening. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. We'll be taking up a motion later to allow that evening hearing to take place with only a week's notice.
Right. So it's at 2 o'clock and at 6 o'clock. We'll begin again.
And when does it come back to council for possible amendments and further action?
Late 2017.
No, I'm sorry. We have this hearing, week's hearing.
We have a hold on December 7th.
December 7th.
Action on the report.
And that could include amendments, Mayor?
That's
correct.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And then again, that's a report. It has the policy direction as we see it at that point, and then it will go into the code writing process into next year.
When on December 7th?
It's not a time certain.
Is it a time certain? 2 p.m.? Okay, it is 2 p.m. Okay.
And with that, I'll pass it along to Morgan to walk you through the proposal.
Okay. Thank you, Sandra.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Sandra. So real quickly, we spent some time last week going a little into we went into a lot more detail on these topics, but for the benefit of the public and those watching, I wanted to give a quick overview of the project and where we are. So Portland 2035, you guys just adopted a new comprehensive plan. At the heart of it, Portland is going to be a prosperous, healthy, resilient, and equitable city. A big part of that equity piece is opportunity for all. Over the next 20 years, we anticipate another 123,000 households moving to the area. That growth is what's going to shape the city. The discussion around the comp plan has been focused over the next 20 years, building on the foundation of the city's past successes. While the city as a whole has the zone capacity to accommodate our 20-year projected growth, a lot of our single dwelling areas are built out. Part of this project is to broaden the types of housing we have available in these areas. So here's where we are today. This is Portland in 2015, and essentially we have two predominant housing types: detached housing, which comprises about 56% of our housing stock, and apartments, which is about 39%. What is lacking is a broader mix of these other types, duplexes, ADUs, attached houses. While the single-dwelling zones account for 45% of the city's land area, only 20% of the growth is expected in these areas. Sandra mentioned our project goals and objectives. The goal of this project is to identify ways the single-dwelling zones can be adapted over the long term to provide greater variety of housing choices to suit our current and future needs. We looked to the policies in the comprehensive plan to identify the 8 key objectives you see on the wheel here that apply to this project. Some are mutually reinforcing, like maintaining open space and fitting neighborhood context, while others may conflict. This project aims to optimize and advance each of these 8 objectives. To do this, the project addresses 3 topic areas: scale of houses, housing types, and development on narrow lots. The first image here shows a range of house sizes on 5,000 square foot lots. On the left is a typical older Portland home, and on the far right is the largest house one can build under today's code, coming in at 6,750 square feet. In 2013, about 60% of homes built on 5,000 square foot lots were larger than 2,500 square feet, and the largest house built was just over 4,400. The first recommendation would limit house sizes in the R5 zone on 5,000 square foot lots to 2,500 square feet. This particular size limit would vary by the zone and the size of the lot the house is built on. Recommendation number 2 proposes to lower the house roof line. The current code sets the height limit at 30 feet and measures from a base point at the highest grade next to a house, which is shown in the house on the left. These two requirements in conjunction can sometimes have the result of homes that are 3 or even 4 stories tall. The recommendation would limit homes to 2.5 stories and better relate height measurements to the street. And the third scale recommendation addresses setbacks. So recommendation number 3 would increase front setbacks, but also acknowledges that in some areas, the established setbacks of existing homes along the street are smaller. As this image shows, the proposal would increase the front setback by 5 feet, but would allow homes to reduce the setback to match their adjacent house where this condition exists. So just want to take a quick pause here. One of a rather significant part of this project is the proposed size limitation is a significant reduction in what's allowed today, about 60% reduction over what's allowed today. The second topic addresses housing choice recommendations. While the last topic proposed reducing the allowed size of houses, this topic includes recommendations to allow more flexibility for what can happen within reduced building envelopes. Recommendations number 4 and number 5 essentially work together. Number 4 describes the types of housing that would be allowed. Number 5 describes where they would be allowed. So while single-family residential zones generally means one house per lot, Portland Zoning Code already includes multiple exceptions to this rule. This slide shows some of those exceptions. So currently, all lots are allowed one accessory dwelling unit, either inside or outside the house. Duplexes are allowed on all corner lots. And other code exceptions, like one additional unit, is allowed for lots bordering commercial properties. Under the proposal, these code allowances would generally be increased by one unit within some areas of the city. Single houses, currently allowed only one ADU, would be allowed both an internal and an external ADU. Duplexes, which are now only allowed on corner lots, would be allowed on all lots. And on corner lots, where duplexes are currently allowed, triplexes would be allowed. The key is that regardless of whether the new development is a house, a duplex, or a triplex, the size of the building will still be capped at the same size allowed for a single house. It's also important to note that this development will also be subject to additional design standards to ensure the form is compatible. So now that we've defined the size and housing types, this map shows where they would be allowed. The boundary of the conceptual housing opportunity overlay zone is made up of areas within a quarter mile of centers, frequent service transit, MAC stations, and within inner rings areas and around the central city and higher housing opportunity neighborhoods. In other words, these are areas that have the characteristics that support prosperous households: access to good transit, have active transportation networks, are near daily commercial services, parks, schools, and other desired amenities. It's important to note that this overlay zone is conceptual. Further boundary refinements will be done in 2017 to reflect property lines, constraints from physical barriers, topography, as well as other practical considerations.
That's not a lot-by-lot map built up from the zoning code map, right?
This is not. This is essentially a bubble diagram showing general proximity of the proposed overlay.
And is the intent to look into whether there are all these things that you mentioned, like schools, parks, sidewalks, traffic lights, and things.
Right. So the further analysis we do as part of the specific mapping, if this is the concept that the council agrees to, is to go back and look at a parcel-specific map and refine those boundaries to accomplish
those goals. Why did we not think about do that during the comprehensive plan map process?
I think some of this is embedded in the comprehensive plan process. For example, where we pulled this from was from Chapter 5 of the Comprehensive Plan about housing opportunity areas, which were areas that had good access to active transportation, is the word that the policy uses, good schools, complete communities. And they worked with us to the Housing Bureau worked with us to derive that map of, like, what areas of the city that when you live there do you have less cost for transportation and housing combined. So that's kind of embedded and it's working together with us.
The other explicit comp plan policy relates to middle housing, which defines looking at areas of opportunity within a quarter mile of the center's corridors and so forth.
One of the challenges I think we have here is that, first of all, you call it conceptual, and that people are reading in different definitions of what that means. And second, this diagram makes it appear that virtually the entire east side is covered by this overlay zone, and so it doesn't quite seem to be as discrete as, you know, linked to corridors and town centers. So I think we're going to get a lot of testimony on this, and I think, frankly, I'm still a little unclear about if we adopted this at a concept level, what the next steps are. And I think it might be helpful to get some clarification on that before we start getting a lot of testimony.
Okay.
Because we did hear a lot of testimony when we discussed those policies that it wasn't going to be just blanket everywhere. It was going to be a lot more targeted. So I think that's what I'd like to hear from you.
Yeah, and I think the policy you adopt in the comp plan says where appropriate. Mm-hmm. So figuring out where appropriate is definitely part of the next discussion.
You also brought up issues at the briefing, just asking about the difference between a base zone and an overlay zone approach. So the answer to that lies somewhere in the resulting form. So with multi-dwelling zones where multiple units are allowed on the lot, such as R2, and in fact multiple minimum densities are required, the scale and intensity of development is greater than what we would characteristically see in single-dwelling zones. Also, while there's opportunity for diversity of housing types, as the lot size increases or as lots are aggregated together, the form starts to shift from mid-rise to multi-unit apartments. So this slide is showing three examples depicting small lot development, individual single houses, a four-story multi-unit building, and an apartment complex. These are all within the R2 zone and within about 12 blocks of each other. This is not what we're proposing for the additional housing types. Conversely, what we are describing is something that is tied to form with limited density allowances, so not a minimum density requirement. The form is compatible in scale and arrangement as single dwelling houses, but the density is flexible up to 3 units. So these two examples are showing duplexes that have been blended in with single houses. The overlay allows the existing pattern and scale of alternative housing types to coexist with other single dwelling houses. So beyond the additional housing types proposed, recommendation number 6 includes more flexibility for a housing configuration referred to as a cottage cluster. These are multiple smaller units on larger lots, often surrounding common green spaces, that are typically compatible in single-dwelling neighborhoods. They are currently allowed through a plan development process, but do not allow any accessory dwelling units, so some number of units are foregone under our current rules. The proposed rules would allow cottage cluster developments to attain the maximum unit allowances prescribed for the base zone. And to help advance other city goals, the proposal includes a provision to allow additional units when those units are accessible or affordable. So we also heard through our public outreach a lot of continuing concern about demolitions, and that resulted in refining our proposal to address specifically existing houses and provide some additional flexibility for them. So these proposed rules add flexibility for adaptive reuse and for retaining existing houses, including a modest size limit bonus to accommodate remodels and additions, flexibility in the height when a house's old foundation is being replaced, and an allowance for one additional unit within the housing opportunity overlay area when converting to multiple units or when you're incorporating the house into a cottage cluster. The third set of topics gets at narrow lot recommendations. were historic plats that were recorded at the turn of the last century before modern zoning was in place. Some of these older plats were created with 25 or 33-foot wide lots. This map is showing the concentration of these narrow lot plats in various parts of the city. These lots, though substandard in size and width, can be built on if they have been vacant for at least 5 years. Recommendation 8 essentially acknowledges that development on skinny lots in the R5 zone is not intuitive and doesn't reflect the lot size pattern, and proposes to rezone these historically narrow lots to R2.5. These lots are also located in areas that are close to centers and corridors, but unlike standard-sized R5 lots that would be within this housing overlay area, these allow for a duplex, these lots provide options for fee-simple homeownership of smaller houses.
And again, I think the community is going to be looking for reassurance that we are going to do more specific than just the quarter mile to transit, because, of course, you have to look at, is there a sidewalk, and is it the other side of a barrier like a freeway or a cliff or something? Thanks.
So with this additional R2.5 zoned area, Recommendation 9 proposes several improvements to development in this zone. This shows 4 variants of house development that could result in the R2.5 zone. So where a house is being retained, as the house on the left, new rules would permit a property line adjustment to create flag lots. On lots where a house is demolished, new houses would be required to be attached. On large vacant sites, those at least 5,000 square feet, 2 units would be required, either a duplex or a house with an ADU. And on other vacant sites, pre-existing lots could be confirmed or large lots divided for detached or attached houses.
So how is this different? Is this being added to all 2.5 zones or just the skinny lot 2.5s?
This would apply to all 2.5 zones.
Vacant 2.5 zones.
No, all of them.
No, all 2.5 zones.
Oh, I see. At least 5,000 square feet. I got
right.
It.
Okay, yeah. So we shifted a little bit. I think the conversation about where to allow it was to then rezone areas to R2.5, and then we took a look at all the R2.5 areas, not just the ones that are already zoned that, but the ones that in the comprehensive plan you're considering to rezone that, and these new ones, and improving the R2.5 zone so the product we get for R2.5 is more in keeping and consistent with what we're aiming for.
And why aren't they allowed to do attached houses like the 2.5 zone is anyway?
They are. So that's example number 2.
That's number 2.
Yes.
Okay. And then in the third option, it's basically being built at R5 but requiring an ADU.
Yeah. So in situations where you have an R2.5 zone lot that's 5,000 square feet and zone 4, 2 units, this would require either a duplex to get to 2 units or a house with an ADU to get to those 2 units.
But if it's a house with an ADU, we're actually losing home ownership options in that zone.
Right. So the trade-off there is if we required fee-simple ownership, we would be forcing property owners to go through a land division process where they had a large site. So this is one, not narrow lots, but one big parcel of land developed with a house wouldn't be required to build a second or build an ADU.
And do we have any evidence that in the current R2.5 zones, there's a desire to do just one house instead of 2?
Less so under the current market conditions, but it was happening previously in the last, 2008 to 2013 realm. So we have to kind of be thinking about the fluctuations and how this would play out over the course of 20 years.
It just seems in 3, we're losing development capacity.
We're keeping the number of units consistent with the underlying zone intensity, but we are losing out on the land division if that was the ultimate objective. Recommendation number 10 relates to garages and parking on these narrow lots. So as you can see in this photo, the driveways occupy most of the front yard, remove available on-street parking, and take up space for street trees. Additionally, on these narrow lots, the width of the garage door dominates the front facade and occupies much of the ground floor living area. The proposal would no longer allow street-facing garages for detached skinny houses, leaving room for on-street parking, larger front yards, and more street trees. The proposal would also not require parking on narrow lots, but would still allow it. The image in the top left shows a few options for accommodating parking for detached skinny houses, either on the street, accessed by an alley, or via a shared driveway to parking in the back. For attached houses, Garages would be allowed if driveways were combined and tucked under the first floor. So the combination of these recommendations for these three topic areas will ensure new infill is better scaled and proportionally related to the size of the lot it sits on, encourage more smaller units that are comparably less expensive than large new single-family houses, and provide more options to a broader spectrum of home seekers in places they wish to live. So before we begin public testimony, I'd like to invite Catherine Schultz, Chair of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and Teresa St. Martin, who is our PSC representative on our Stakeholder Advisory Committee, to come up and share a few words.
Great. Come on up, please, Teresa.
Kat.
I think Eli might use your well, but we'll let these two start anyway. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. Thank you, Mayor Hales and Commissioners. The PSC was briefed on October 25th. It should be noted that we did not have the opportunity for hearings or the benefit of public testimony. And I'm here to share some of our initial reactions that we had in our briefing. As you all know, as stewards of the comp plan, we use it as a lens through which we review any proposal. Overall, we believe that the concepts in the residential infill project are headed in the right direction, and they forward many of the comprehensive plan goals. Reducing the scale of new houses addresses many of the community's concerns. Increasing housing choice in more areas of the city makes more of the city accessible to more Portlanders. The commission was very excited, or was very interested, in the economic implications of the concept. We did not have time to dive into them. You'll see them in your appendix. And therefore, we encourage you to carefully consider those implications as you deliberate. We are looking forward to our formal review during the legislative process, and we'll be providing our recommendation to you on that next year. I have Commissioner St. Martin here joining us, and she was on the Residential Infill Project Advisory Committee, and she can actually share a lot more of the specifics and the concerns that she heard throughout that process.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you. So we spent 12 months, 16 meetings, and over 1,000 hours, and this was an amazing process. This was the first Stakeholder Advisory Committee I had the privilege to be on, and it's amazing to see what people can come and share and be a part of trying to make our city better. I will say that these issues have direct impact right in the heart of where people live in our homes. So you're going to get a lot of very interesting testimony. This is a really close issue for folks. Of the three topics that we covered for the project, the scale of housing had the most consensus, although we didn't vote and this was not a consensus product. It is a conglomeration of the ideas that we discussed and learned about. For the housing choice topic, we really didn't have one single position on the SAC. Members either felt that the proposals didn't go far enough and that we should extend this to all parts of the city to increase the diversity of housing, and then there were those who felt that the proposal went too far, was not nuanced enough to really reflect what is the appropriate expansion of diverse housing in the city. So the concepts that Morgan talked about, you know, there's eight of them. I'm not going to go through each of them, but fitting neighborhood context was really important and was really up at the top of the list of the folks that were on the committee, and that's, you know, to keep Portland the charming place we all know and love, but still allowing other people to live here. Providing the diverse housing opportunities, we have to think about multi-generational living, you know, both parents or children who are coming out of college or experiencing an economic disruption, as well as other people who need affordable homes. Allowing houses to be adapted over time was a very important issue to help reduce our demolitions, and that has to do with internal conversions and other ways to get more things into the same box without destroying the beautiful 100-year-old box that we have. And then lastly, to provide clear rules for development. We need to make sure that our development community and the people who live here and have really holding a lot of their wealth generation in their homes and land have clear rules on what can be done, hoping to keep it affordable and appropriate as we continue to develop our city. As the PSC representative, I think the staff did a fantastic job of gathering together all of these issues with through lots of emotion and lots of public testimony. You're going to get your opportunity to hear a lot of that shortly. Just to alert you of a couple things you will hear about that we didn't really include in the plan. One is the urban forest canopy and provisions for maintaining that, you know, as we do more infill development. That's something that we have to keep a concern of. Also, land division rules for the cottage clusters to enable fee simple ownership for affordability. And then internal conversions and what can be allowed there, somewhat of respect to the historic way that we see. You know, like over in Belmont, you see lots of big boxes that are sixplexes, but they look like giant houses. So anyway, that internal conversion rules, those are a little bit more complicated. So thank you very much, and we look forward to continuing the robust discussions and coming up with something that will really make Portland shine and also to allow us to be a leader in a leadership position on the middle housing issue that really is striking our entire country.
Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you both for your service. On the internal conversions, does the code specify that that's only allowed if you keep the existing house?
There is, as far as I understand, there's no specificity to that because it was a topic that we started to discuss, but we really didn't get fully laid out just based on timing. You know, you could see how many things you could put into one, you know, we call them ADUs or detached ADUs. So that's a little different than converting something into a fourplex or whatever.
Yeah, I'm just concerned about the developer doesn't necessarily have that much incentive. It's only if you're currently living in a house convert it so you can maybe stay there. Otherwise, I'm not sure how that really stops the demolition, because if you can do it and build it new, that tends to be more expensive.
Well, let's flag that issue and ask for testimony on that issue and also staff discussion, because it was very much the intent that was to try to provide an incentive to keep the old building, even if the configuration of how people live inside of it changes.
I'm just concerned that actually it is an incentive, because then you can do more units and build it new. I'm not sure how that stops the scraping.
I think that's something
to look at.
That's a good question. Okay, other questions for our two stellar volunteers here. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know we have some other volunteers here, some board and commission members, and maybe other stakeholder advisory committee members that would like to speak. Please. Come on up. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me here. I'm Eli Spivak. I serve on the Planning Commission and also was on the Residential Infill Project. And my comments maybe have a little more edge because I'll speak for myself and the commission member, but I'll say that I've heard the claim that the Residential Infill Project will destroy the character of neighborhoods around Portland. And I just want to invite you that if you hear that also in testimony, I hope you'll empathize with the concerns people express, which are fair. For many people, buying a house is their big investment in life, and if things change around them, then it can feel like a threat. But I also hope that you'll think of these neighborhoods you're very familiar with and think of people who live in those neighborhoods, people who teach the neighborhood school, work at the coffee shop, clean houses, do landscaping, do they have any chance of living in the neighborhood too? And I hope that you'll think of this code process as a way to ensure that there are places within any neighborhood for people providing those essential services to live. There's a long and fortunate history in our country of zoning used as an exclusionary tool, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. During World War II, when we absorbed 194,000 residents in a few years for the war effort, our lowest density neighborhoods, which weren't very extensive back then, were left largely off the hook. So in the war code, 1942 war code, which mostly relaxed the rules of the game, you could slice and dice houses, all kinds of stuff, it had in there nice clauses like, no new building coming under the regulations of this ordinance shall be located in a Class 1 residential district or a Class 1 special two-family residential district. And if you do convert an existing building in one of those districts to multiple units, then you have to get buy-off from 60% of the people who own private property within 200 feet. That's white picket fence zoning. Our 1% zoning, as Novick coined a while ago. And
please
we can do,
don't repeat that.
And we can do better than that. Now we've got 45% of our city with that same single-family zoning. Do we have a chance of meeting our equity goals if we don't allow a broader mix of housing types in our neighborhoods? As proposed by staff, they'd be required to be tucked within the size constraints of a single-family home, as staff's already shared. except that the size would be capped at 2,500 square feet, which is smaller than 59% of new single-family homes built in Portland on 5,000 square feet lots in 2013. So the size cap is less than 59% of homes getting built. I've heard the concern that if we adopt this package, every lot will get built that way, corner triplexes, double ADUs, you know, courtyard plexes. I've also heard the concern that only weird developers like me would ever build the stuff, given the choice. I think we would end up with something in between, and we can look back to history one more time for that. If you look at the older neighborhoods of Portland, where you could by right have built every single lot with a courtyard plex, that's not what happened. We've done tours of this. We see those plexes, but there's also many single-family homes, mostly single-family homes that were built where they could have built something more intense instead. So I think what you'll see is a variety of housing types, which is exactly what we need. So I'd say the staff's done a terrific job with this code update. It could and should go further to support internal conversions of existing homes citywide, preserving urban forest canopy, and providing support for affordable and accessible housing. But I would say that what's eroding the affordability, character, and housing choices in our neighborhoods is not the RIP project, the Residential Infill Project. It's the zoning rules on the books today. And we got a chance to change them, so let's do it.
Eli, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Because you were one of the more thoughtful people that comes before us on this subject. When I joined this council, the hot subject at the time was whether we would erode the urban growth boundary to accommodate growth. And the council has historically said, no, we're going to protect the urban growth boundary because we believe in it. But we also understood we're going to have to take more people, and the question was, where do we put the density? And historically, the council has said that we could focus density in places like town centers and corridors and certain areas while also doing our best to preserve the, quote, character of our residential neighborhoods. Now, that's a very broad proposition. And now we're trying to figure out how to accommodate enormous growth, how to deal with an affordability crisis, how to bring an equity lens, and how to balance all these things. Mm-hmm. And this is a high concept proposal before us. There's work to be done where it gets translated into action. But my sense is that we're trying to balance a number of core values, and we're trying to figure out where is the line. And do you have any further guidance for us as to how to balance our desire to protect the urban growth boundary, focus density where we can accommodate it, and protect some of the, quote, character of our more established neighborhoods?
I think this proposal does a terrific job of maintaining the character of neighborhoods. We've actually tuned down significantly the size of what can get built. What people are complaining about now is what's being built under current codes, and this changes that. And if preserving character of neighborhoods means fewer people can live in them, then I guess I'm going to disagree with that definition. I think that's a proxy for an exclusionary zoning. But if preserving character of neighborhoods means it's still got the look and feel of single-family homes, even if there's an ADU where maybe a garage would have been, then that's exactly what this proposal does. And I think that having an increased population density, and one of the things I fear is that Portland, as the further out parts get built closer to the growth boundary, that it'll be a monocrop of big single-family homes that will never have the population density it takes to support the vibrant, walkable neighborhoods that we are bidding up right now. And we need more of those neighborhoods. And the way to get those more neighborhoods is to have a mixture of housing types even further away from the core.
Eli, one discussion we've had is if the result of allowing for middle housing is a bunch of $400,000 duplexes, well, how can you consider that affordable? And isn't that kind of pointless? A counterargument would be that if the alternative is single-family homes that all cost more than $750,000, then $400,000 might not seem all that affordable, but it's a heck of a lot more affordable than $750,000. Do you have any thoughts about that argument?
I think it's relatively affordable. I mean, I think that in our, I mean, it's not, I mean, I come from an affordable housing background. This is not getting you the affordable housing, except for in very limited ways by some nonprofits that specialize in for-sale neighborhood-based housing. They really get very far down the income level. But it is valuable to have in a market that's building $750,000 homes, that's all they can, that's what pencils, to let them build two 400s instead, that's better. And if you can have a house that's $750,000 but it's got an ADU tucked in the corner that might be rented at a pretty affordable rate, that's better. I live right in a neighborhood where behind my house, I live in half of a duplex, there's a totally developable lot that when it gets built out, it's going to be 10 feet from my back door, and I have the middle-class anxiety that that's going to, you know, shade me out. But if something's going to get built there, I'd much rather be something that at least part of that structure is someone who teaches at the school down the street can afford to live in. And that's not going to be the case with the $715,000 house. So I think that this tool is limited. It's not the only tool on the books, but it's an important one to allow us to have a variety of housing types.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Welcome. pardon. My name is Leroy Patton, and I'm president of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. And I want to talk about the 1959 City of Portland banned multifamily dwellings, such as duplexes, fourplexes, and internal home divisions. Since 1959, city code has made it illegal to build more neighborhoods with this classification of middle housing. This has contributed to the deep Portland housing shortage, driving the poorest Portlanders out of their homes. By being forced to move, these same families lose out on job opportunities that are available in the city. This code has been used for 60 years. It is now time to reassess its value to Portland. These small, efficient ways to live, duplexes, fourplexes, and internal home divisions, encourage the development of small stores, markets, bus line viability, and walkable neighborhoods. All Portlanders would benefit from such improvements. We urge you to support the missing middle housing amendment to the city's comprehensive plan by implementing the following regulations. Revise the zoning code to allow for middle housing types in existing residential neighborhoods. Remove the barriers to housing development of these projects. Allow more missing middle types in all Portland neighborhoods. Support rules that incentivize efficient use of smaller spaces and energy-efficient buildings. Bring more affordable housing options online for future needs. Eliminate McMansions and encourage the building of smaller houses. Land use decisions made today will directly affect housing abundance, diversity, and affordability. We need to make sure that housing reflects these values for all Portlanders. Please consider revising the 1959 city code to accommodate the needs of all Portlanders.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both very much. Okay, before we turn to the sign-up sheet again, we usually grant the courtesies to people with disabilities or people with small children or who have caregiver responsibilities. If you're here and fit that description, you know who you are. And if you'd like to afford yourself that privilege to come up first, come on up and or come up as soon as you can make it to the hearing part of the room from upstairs. And while we wait for anybody that fits that description, we'll go ahead and start the sign-up sheet, please.
We have a total of 82 people signed up.
Okay.
The first three, please come on up, are Robin Harmon, Elaine Friesen-Strand, and Sam Noble. And that's 1, 2, and 3. And they'll be followed by Maggie McGann, Jim Gorder, and Michael Molinaro.
Great. So, folks, obviously it's our goal to hear as many of you as possible. Quantity is nice, but quality is better. So if somebody has already covered your point, feel free to either forego or just second someone else's testimony. The goal of this hearing is to get the issues on the record and get a sense of how it's received in the community. So your say matters, but we'd urge you to not be repetitive.
There's 2 minutes.
I think I would like to go to 2 minutes if we can all flex to that. I know you may have written your testimony to go longer, but again, in the goal of hearing as many people as possible, let's try to stick to a 2-minute limit at all possible. Thank you. So who'd ever like to go first? I think you've got that.
My name's Robin Harmon. I spent the last year as a citizen of the city going to all of these meetings.
Thank you.
They called me the 27th member of the committee. the project goal is stated in fall of 2015, and I will read you, to ensure that new or remodeled houses are well integrated and complement the fabric of the neighborhood. We saw that morph very quickly over time. You heard about a supposedly diverse committee. If you look very carefully, it is heavily weighted with developers, builders, their lobbyists, and housing advocates. Somebody that just spoke today also is helping push this proposal through, happens to build the type of housing that would benefit, and is also on the Planning Commission. I was appalled to watch them group together and hijack the process and put through a very self-serving agenda that and wrap it in the disguise of affordable housing, which it will not create. We all want a suitable and affordable housing, but this proposal will not create affordable housing, and it would increase demolitions and displacement dramatically. It was the process was staff was unresponsive to the public process, despite extremely strong opposition voiced in public testimony. Of the 27 neighborhood associations that expressed thoughtful comments about the proposal, 27 out of 31 were strongly opposed to widespread middle housing. There has been virtually, if you look carefully at the details of this proposal, there was no attempt to respect neighborhood character. This is no grand bargain. Fully a third of the committee does not support it, and there was no compromise. I ask you to very carefully look at this and continue to work on this project, because it would be an entitlement that we have never seen before to allow density to increase on two R5 lots together that would increase the density by 300%. So please look very carefully at the details. You have time to get this right, but this would unleash massive demolitions. It would destroy our neighborhood of South Burlingame, which is in this line drawing. And our density was supposed to be grouped very close to centers and corridors, not this random a quarter mile, which doesn't create walkable cities.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate you being involved. Oh, folks, I forgot to do the ground rules. If you agree with somebody, hold up your hands or give them a thumbs up, and even negative hand gestures if you disagree with them, as long as they're polite ones, are welcome. But we try to not do applause except for visiting dignitaries and school children. So you're an important person, but you're neither a visiting dignitary nor a school child. Let me ask you some questions, Robin. Appreciated your point about this. As you know, this purpose of this hearing is to give guidance to the next phase of this project, not to decide the question. And as always, in something like this, you know, the three choices are do this, do nothing, do something else.
Right.
And there's a consequence to each one of those. I hear right. You saying that you're in the do something else or do this differently category. The more, yes. Not just today, but the more specificity you can give us, you know, is 2,500 feet, square feet, the right number? Are duplexes a good idea? Are triplexes a good idea? You know, those details right. will matter as this turns into details, assuming right. it goes forward. So not just today, but as we go forward, obviously, if you think this can be tuned and get closer to
absolutely.
Your ideal of what should and should not happen,
because right. right.
I think there is a high level of agreement about what we want and what we don't want. We want to preserve the great old houses. We don't want them demolished thoughtlessly and replaced with generic boxes. We want to accommodate different household sizes and
right.
so on. So
right.
I think there's a lot of agreement, but obviously the devil's in the details.
And the devil
and
is in the
details. Matter. So keep that
right.
coming, please.
Well,
I know you've been to 27 meetings.
There's a duplex allowed on every corner now, mm-hmm. and the city's own studies show adequate land for the next 20 years of our growth, and we're not building on the land that's already zoned for multi and single family residential. And so we need to explore that before opening up the whole city. It would take away anybody's sense of truth in zoning in single family residential neighborhoods. So please continue working. The third of the committee opposed to this has put together a very well-balanced proposal that meets all of the goals of new residents, existing residents, and also looks at affordability. And I urge you please to review that carefully.
Okay,
thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask a question, ma'am? Ms. Harmon, I just want to ask you sort of a question of preference. You might say you don't like either of them, but I'd like you to see if you have an answer as to which is more or less preferable. Would it be worse, in your view, to replace a single-family 2,000-square-foot house with a $3,500-square-foot mansion or with two 1,250-square-foot duplexes? Which of those do you think is more destructive to the neighborhood?
I think it depends. It depends on, is there infrastructure in that neighborhood to accommodate the kind of growth in our neighborhood, there it's not very well served by mass transit, even though it's within the quarter mile. So it might be more appropriate in one situation. That's why we have to look more closely at neighborhoods, because it might be better than having cramming a lot of people in there that are just would not be well served, and it's not a walkable neighborhood. And I think we need to also not look at one duplex. Right now, a duplex can be on any corner, but if you're demolishing a lot of single-family residential, it could turn a single-family residential home into primarily rental housing, because there's no limit on this. It's not. This isn't saying it's going to be discreetly sprinkled in the neighborhoods like is being espoused by some.
So you could make the argument that discrete sprinkling has worked out in that we've allowed ADUs over a large swath of the city,
right,
and we've allowed the corner duplexes over a large swaths of the city. We've left it to property owners to decide when and if that happens, and it's only happened at a rather modest rate.
Right. So how much need is there for it?
Well, but
the
need's determined by the market and the ultimate growth of the city, but the when and where and how is determined by the property owner.
The 2,500 square feet for a 5,000 square foot lot is misleading, like quite a bit that's in here, in my opinion, and that it doesn't count garages. And it doesn't count an ADU, I believe, up to 800 square feet. So we all get this picture in our mind of half of the lot being yard. Hmm. And that's not at all the case.
Okay. Fair enough. Thank you very much. Please keep it coming.
Thank you for the
thank
extra
you.
Time.
Go ahead.
Mayor Hales, commissioners, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Elaine Friesen-Strang. My husband and I have been long-term residents in Northeast Portland. In fact, our kids went to the same public schools that my husband did, and it is our hope that we're going to continue to live there as we get older. I'm here today as a volunteer state president for AARP Oregon, and I'm here on behalf of the 65,000 AARP members we have in this city. We believe the report is headed in the right direction. We support the goals of expanding housing choices in terms of size and types of homes, encouraging walkable communities while prioritizing the preservation of neighborhood character. However, there is no provision to foster increased stock of accessible housing. Without adequately addressing this issue, the proposed recommendations cannot make for an effective plan to guide the future development in a city that meets the needs of all its residents. 90% of people age 65 and older want to remain in their own homes as they get older. But if a move becomes necessary because their home is no longer safe or because it doesn't meet their needs, they should not be forced to leave their community, abandon their social networks, or live in age-segregated communities simply because there aren't any other options. And for those who rent, finding homes that are built or remodeled with universal design principles is near impossible. In the next 15 years, our region is expected to see a 106% growth in people aged 65 and older, compared to a projected 35% growth in the other population. And according to CDC, over a third of adults aged 65 and older and 22% of adults report some disability. The truth is, each of us may experience some disability in our lifetime, whether it be from an accident or a mobility challenge caused by a chronic condition. AARP supports the recommendations made by Dr. Alan De La Torre to enact regulatory and incentive-based policies that increase the stock of accessible housing. Please consider examples by other jurisdictions that have already enacted policies, such as Rogue Valley Council of Government, the Montgomery County in Maryland, the City of Austin, and the New York Township of Babylon. This is our chance to meet the needs of all our residents. AARP thanks you for your continued commitment to making Portland a great place for people of all ages and abilities.
Elaine, can I just ask you a follow-up?
And
we're going to try to get through everybody, so we'll start curbing our inclination here. But do you have any suggestions for us in terms of going deeper in requiring levels of accessibility? Because we've received some testimony from allies of AARP saying that this is the opportunity to actually bake into our code more requirements about accessibility.
You're going to hear this afternoon more from Dr. Alan De La Torre to go into that. But I would encourage you to look at what some of these other jurisdictions are doing. The City of Austin, In 2014, their city council approved changes to city building codes to make new homes accessible. Montgomery County has grants and loans to seniors for home modifications. There are tax incentives, expedited permitting,